Goldfinger by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 2. A smile flickered across her mouth.
How long were you there? You gave me a frightful shock.
Not long, and I'm sorry about the shock. Goldfinger's been giving poor old Mr. DuPont shocks for a whole week.
Yes,
she said doubtfully.
I suppose it's really rather mean. But he's very rich, isn't he?
Oh, yes. I shouldn't lose any sleep over Mr. DuPont. But Goldfinger might choose someone who can't afford it. Anyway, he's a zillionaire himself. Why does he do it? He's crawling with money. Animation flooded back into her face.
I know. I simply can't understand him. It's a sort of mania with him making money. He can't leave it alone. I've asked him why, and all he says is that one's a fool not to make money when the odds are right. He's always going on about the same thing, getting the odds right. When he talked me into doing this,
she waved her cigarette at the binoculars,
and I asked him why on earth he bothered, took these stupid risks, all he said was, "That's the second lesson. When the odds aren't right, make them right."
Bond said, "Well, it's lucky for him I'm not Pinkerton's, or the Miami Police Department." The girl shrugged her shoulders.
"Oh, that wouldn't worry him. He'd just buy you off. He can buy anyone off. No one can resist gold."
"What do you mean?" she said indifferently.
"He always carries $1 million worth of gold about with him, except when he's going through the customs. Then he just carries a belt full of gold coins round his stomach. Otherwise it's in thin sheets in the bottom and sides of his suitcases. They're really gold suitcases covered with leather."
"They must weigh a ton."
"He always travels by car, one with special springs, and his chauffeur is a huge man. He carries them. No one else touches them."
"Why does he carry around all that gold?"
"Just in case he needs it. He knows that gold will buy him anything he wants. It's all 24-carat. And anyway, he loves gold, really loves it, like people love jewels or stamps or... well,"
she smiled,
"women."
Bond smiled back. "Does he love you?" She blushed and said indignantly,
"Certainly not."
Then more reasonably,
"Of course you can think anything you like, but really he doesn't. I mean, I think he likes people to think that that is a question of love and all that, you know. He's not very prepossessing, and I suppose it's a question of, well, of vanity or something."
"Yes, I see. So you're just a kind of secretary?"
"Companion,"
she corrected him.
"I don't have to type or anything."
She suddenly put her hand up to her mouth.
"Oh, but I shouldn't be telling you all this. You won't tell him, will you? He'd fire me."
Fright came into her eyes.
"Or something. I don't know what he'd do. He's the sort of man who might do anything."
"Of course I won't tell. But this can't be much of a life for you. Why do you do it?" She said tartly,
£100 a week and all this,"
she waved at the room,
"doesn't grow on trees. I save up. When I've saved enough, I shall go."
Bond wondered if Goldfinger would let her. Wouldn't she know too much? He looked at the beautiful face, the splendid, unself-conscious body. She might not suspect it, but for his money, she was in very bad trouble with this man. The girl was fidgeting. Now she said with an embarrassed laugh,
"I don't think I'm very properly dressed. Can't I go and put something on over these?"
Bond wasn't sure he could trust her. It wasn't he who was paying the £100 a week. He said airily, "You look fine. Just as respectable as those hundreds of people round the pool. Anyway," he stretched, "it's about time to light a fire under Mr. Goldfinger." Bond had been glancing down at the game from time to time. It seemed to be proceeding normally. Bond bent again to the binoculars. Already Mr. DuPont seemed to be a new man. His gestures were expansive. The half-profile of his pink face was full of animation. While Bond watched, he took a fistful of cards out of his hand and spread them down, a pure canaster in kings. Bond tilted the binoculars up an inch. The big red-brown moon face was impassive, uninterested. Mr. Goldfinger was waiting patiently for the odds to adjust themselves back in his favour. While Bond watched, he put up a hand to the hearing aid, pushing the amplifier more firmly into his ear, ready for the signals to come through again. Bond stepped back. "Neat little machine," he commented. "What are you transmitting on?"
"He told me, but I can't remember."
She screwed up her eyes.
170 somethings. Would it be mega-somethings?
Mega-cycles. Might be. But I'd be surprised if he doesn't get a lot of taxicabs and police messages mixed up with your talk. Must have fiendish concentration.
Bond grinned.
Now then. All set? It's time to pull the rug away.
Suddenly she reached out and put a hand on his sleeve. There was a clatter ring on the middle finger. Two gold hands clasped round a gold heart. There were tears in her voice.
Must you? Can't you leave him alone? I don't know what he'll do to me. Please.
She hesitated. She was blushing furiously.
And I like you. It's a long time since I've seen someone like you. Couldn't you just stay here for a little more?
She looked down at the ground.
If only you'd leave him alone, I'd do...
The words came out in a rush.
I'd do anything.
Bond smiled. He took the girl's hand off his arm and squeezed it.
Sorry. I'm being paid to do this job, and I must do it. Anyway, his voice went flat. I want to do it. It's time someone cut Mr. Goldfinger down to size. Ready? Without waiting for an answer, he bent to the binoculars. They were still focused on Goldfinger. Bond cleared his throat. He watched the big face carefully. His hand felt for the microphone switch and pressed it down. There must have been a whisper of static in the deaf aid. Goldfinger's expression didn't alter, but he slowly raised his face to heaven and then down again, as if in benediction. Bond spoke softly, menacingly, into the microphone.
"Now hear me, Goldfinger."
He paused. Not a flicker of expression, but Goldfinger bent his head a fraction as if listening. He studied his cards intently, his hands quite still.
"This is James Bond speaking. Remember me? The game's finished, and it's time to pay. I have a photograph of the whole setup. Blonde, binoculars, microphone, and you and your hearing aid. This photograph will not go to the FBI and Scotland Yard, so long as you obey me exactly. Nod your head if you understand."
The face was still expressionless. Slowly the big round head bent forward and then straightened itself.
"Put your cards down face upwards on the table."
The hands went down. They opened, and the cards slid off the fingers onto the table.
"Take out your checkbook and write a check to cash for $50,000. That is made up as follows. 35 you have taken from Mr. DuPont, 10 for my fee. The extra 5 for wasting so much of Mr. DuPont's valuable time."
Bond watched to see that his order was being obeyed. He took a glance at Mr. DuPont. Mr. DuPont was leaning forward, gaping. Mr. Goldfinger slowly detached the check and countersigned it on the back.
"Right. Now jot this down on the back of your checkbook and see you get it right. Book me a compartment on the Silver Meteor to New York tonight. Have a bottle of vintage champagne on ice in the compartment and plenty of caviar sandwiches, the best caviar. And keep away from me. And no monkey business. The photograph will be in the mails, with a full report to be opened and acted upon if I don't show up in good health in New York tomorrow. Nod if you understand."
Again the big head came slowly down and up again. Now there were traces of sweat on the high, unlined forehead.
"Right. Now hand the check across to Mr. DuPont and say, 'I apologize humbly. I have been cheating you.' Then you can go."
Bond watched the hand go across and drop the check in front of Mr. DuPont. The mouth opened and spoke. The eyes were placid, slow. Goldfinger had relaxed. It was only money. He had paid his way out.
"Just a moment, Goldfinger. You're not through yet."
Bond glanced up at the girl. She was looking at him strangely. There was misery and fear, but also a look of submissiveness, of longing.
"What's your name?"
"Jill Masterton."
Goldfinger had stood up, was turning away. Bond said sharply,
"Stop."
Goldfinger stopped in mid-stride. Now his eyes looked up at the balcony. They had opened wide as when Bond had first met him. Their hard, level, X-ray gaze seemed to find the lenses of the binoculars, travel down them and through Bond's eyes to the back of his skull. They seemed to say,
"I shall remember this, Mr. Bond."
Bond said softly, "I'd forgotten. One last thing. I shall be taking a hostage for the ride to New York. Miss Masterton, see that she's at the train. Oh, and make that compartment a drawing room. That's all. Chapter 5. Night Duty. It was a week later. Bond stood at the open window of the seventh-floor office of the tall building in Regent's Park that is the headquarters of the Secret Service. London lay asleep under a full moon that rode swiftly over the town through a shoal of herringbone clouds. Big Ben sounded three. One of the telephones rang in the dark room. Bond turned and moved quickly to the central desk and the pool of light cast by the green-shaded reading lamp. He picked up the black telephone from the rank of four. He said, "Duty officer?"
"Station H, sir."
"Put them on." There was the echoing buzz and twang of the usual bad radio connection with Hong Kong. Why were there always sunspots over China? A sing-song voice asked, "Universal export?" "Yes." A deep, close voice, London, said,
"You're through to Hong Kong. Speak up, please."
Bond said impatiently, "Clear the line, please." The sing-song voice said,
"You're through now. Speak up, please."
"Hello? Hello? Universal export?"
"Yes."
"Dixon speaking. Can you hear me?"
"Yes."
"That cable I sent you about the shipment of mangoes. Fruit, you know?"
"Yes. Got it here." Bond pulled the file towards him. He knew what it was about. Station H wanted some limpet mines to put paid to three communist spy junks that were using Macau to intercept British freighters and search them for refugees from China.
"Must have payment by the 10th.
That would mean that the junks were leaving, or else that the guards on the junks would be doubled after that date, or some other emergency. Bond said briefly, "Wilco."
"Thanks. Bye."
"Bye." Bond put down the receiver. He picked up the green receiver and dialed Q branch and talked to the section duty officer. It would be all right. There was a BOAC Britannia leaving in the morning. Q branch would see that the crate caught the plane. Bond sat back. He reached for a cigarette and lit it. He thought of the badly air-conditioned little office on the waterfront in Hong Kong, saw the sweat marks on the white shirt of 279, whom he knew well and who had just called himself Dixon. Now 279 would probably be talking to his number two.
"It's okay. London says can do. Let's just go over this ops schedule again."
Bond smiled wryly. Better they than he. He never liked being up against the Chinese. There were too many of them. Station H might be stirring up a hornet's nest, but M had decided it was time to show the opposition that the service in Hong Kong hadn't quite gone out of business. When, 3 days before, M had first told him his name was down for night duty, Bond hadn't taken to the idea. He had argued that he didn't know enough about the routine work of the stations, that it was too responsible a job to give a man who had been in the 00 section for 6 years, and who had forgotten all he had ever known about station work.
"You'll soon pick it up," M had said unsympathetically. "If you get in trouble, there are the duty section officers, or the chief of staff, or me, for the matter of that."
Bond had smiled at the thought of waking M up in the middle of the night because some man in Aden or Tokyo was in a flap.
"Anyway, I've decided. I want all senior officers to do their spell of routine."
M had looked frostily across at Bond.
"Matter of fact, 007, I had the Treasury on to me the other day. Their liaison man thinks the 00 section is redundant. Says that kind of thing is out of date. I couldn't bother to argue."
M's voice was mild.
"Just told him he was mistaken."
Bond could visualize the scene.
"However, won't do any harm for you to have some extra duties now you're back in London. Keep you from getting stale."
And Bond wasn't minding it. He was halfway through his first week, and so far it had just been a question of common sense, or passing routine problems on down to the sections. He rather liked the peaceful room, and knowing everybody's secrets, and being occasionally fed coffee and sandwiches by one of the pretty girls from the canteen. On the first night, the girl had brought him tea. Bond had looked at her severely. "I don't drink tea. I hate it. It's mud. Moreover, it's one of the main reasons for the downfall of the British Empire. Be a good girl and make me some coffee." The girl had giggled and scurried off to spread Bond's dictum in the canteen. From then on he had got his coffee. The expression, a cup of mud, was seeping through the building. A second reason why Bond enjoyed the long vacuum of night duty was that it gave him time to get on with a project he had been toying with for more than a year, a handbook of all secret methods of unarmed combat. It was to be called Stay Alive. It would contain the best of all that had been written on the subject by the secret services of the world. Bond had told no one of the project, but he hoped that, if he could finish it, M would allow it to be added to the short list of service manuals which contained the tricks and techniques of secret intelligence. Bond had borrowed the original textbooks, or, where necessary, translations from records. Most of the books had been captured from enemy agents or organizations. Some had been presented to M by sister services such as OSS, CIA, and the DSM. Now Bond drew towards him a particular prize, a translation of the manual entitled simply Defense, issued to operatives of SMERSH, the Soviet Organization of Vengeance and Death. That night he was halfway through Chapter 2, whose title, freely translated, was Come Along and Restraint Holds. Now he went back to the book and read for half an hour through the sections dealing with the conventional wrist come along, arm lock come along, forearm lock, head hold, and use of neck pressure points. After half an hour, Bond thrust the typescript away from him. He got up and went across to the window and stood looking out. There was a nauseating toughness in the blunt prose the Russians used. It had brought on another of the attacks of revulsion to which Bond had succumbed 10 days before at Miami Airport. What was wrong with him? Couldn't he take it any more? Was he going soft, or was he only stale? Bond stood for a while, watching the moon riding, careering through the clouds. Then he shrugged his shoulders and went back to his desk. He decided that he was as fed up with the variations of violent physical behavior as a psychoanalyst must become with the mental aberrations of his patients. Bond read again the passage that had revolted him. A drunken woman can also usually be handled by using the thumb and forefinger to grab the lower lip. By pinching hard and twisting, as the pull is made, the woman will come along. Bond grunted. The obscene delicacy of that thumb and forefinger. Bond lit a cigarette and stared into the filament of the desk light, switching his mind to other things, wishing that a signal would come in, or the telephone ring. Another 5 hours to go before the 9 o'clock report to the chief of staff, or to M, if M happened to come in early. There was something nagging at his mind, something he had wanted to check on when he had the time. What was it? What had triggered off the reminder? Yes, that was it. Forefinger. Goldfinger. He would see if records had anything on the man. Bond picked up the green telephone and dialed records.
"Doesn't ring a bell, sir. I'll check and call you back."
Bond put down the receiver. It had been a wonderful trip up in the train. They had eaten the sandwiches and drunk the champagne, and then, to the rhythm of the giant diesels pounding out the miles, they had made long, slow love in the narrow berth. It had been as if the girl was starved of physical love. She had woken him twice more in the night with soft, demanding caresses, saying nothing, just reaching for his hard, lean body. The next day she had twice pulled down the roller blinds to shut out the hard light, and had taken him by the hand and said, "Love me, James," as if she was a child asking for a sweet. Even now Bond could hear the quick silver poem of the level crossing bells, the wail of the big wind horn out front, and the quiet outside clamour at the stations when they lay and waited for the sensual gallop of the wheels to begin again. Jill Masterton had said that Goldfinger had been relaxed, indifferent over his defeat. He had told the girl to tell Bond that he would be over in England in a week's time, and would like to have that game of golf at Sandwich. Nothing else. No threats, no curses. He had said he would expect the girl back by the next train. Jill had told Bond she would go. Bond had argued with her, but she was not frightened of Goldfinger. What could he do to her? And it was a good job. Bond had decided to give her the $10,000 Mr. DuPont had shuffled into his hand with a stammer of thanks and congratulations. Bond made her take the money. "I don't want it," Bond had said. "Wouldn't know what to do with it. Anyway, keep it as mad money in case you want to get away in a hurry. It ought to be a million. I shall never forget last night and today." Bond had taken her to the station, and had kissed her once, hard on the lips, and had gone away. It hadn't been love, but a quotation had come into Bond's mind as his cab moved out of Pennsylvania Station. "Some love is fire, some love is rust, but the finest, cleanest love is lust." Neither had had regrets. Had they committed a sin? If so, which one? A sin against chastity? Bond smiled to himself. There was a quotation for that, too, and from a saint. St. Augustine. O Lord, give me chastity, but don't give it yet. The green telephone rang.
3 Goldfingers, sir, but 2 of them are dead. The 3rd's a Russian post office in Geneva. Got a hairdressing business. Slips the messages into the right-hand coat pocket when he brushes the customers down. He lost a leg at Stalingrad. Any good, sir? There's plenty more on him.
No, thanks. That couldn't be my man.
We could put a trace through CID records in the morning. Got a picture, sir?
Bond remembered the Leica film. He hadn't even bothered to have it developed. It would be quicker to mock up the man's face on the identicast. He said, "Is the identicast room free?"
"Yes, sir. And I can operate it for you if you like."
"Thanks, I'll come down." Bond told the switchboard to let heads of sections know where he would be, and went out and took the lift down to records on the first floor. The big building was extraordinarily quiet at night. Beneath the silence there was a soft whisper of machinery and hidden life, the muffled clack of a typewriter as Bond passed a door, a quickly suppressed stammer of radio static as he passed another, the soft background whine of the ventilation system. It gave you the impression of being in a battleship in harbour. The records duty officer was already at the controls of the identicast in the projection room. He said to Bond,
"Could you give me the main lines of the face, sir? That'll help me leave out the slides that are obviously no good."
Bond did so and sat back and watched the lighted screen. The identicast is a machine for building up an approximate picture of a suspect, or of someone who has perhaps only been glimpsed in a street, or a train, or in a passing car. It works on the magic lantern principle. The operator flashes on the screen various head shapes and sizes. When one is recognized, it stays on the screen. Then various haircuts are shown, and then all the other features follow, and are chosen one by one. Different shapes of eyes, noses, chins, mouths, eyebrows, cheeks, ears. In the end, there is the whole picture of a face, as near as the scanner can remember it, and it is photographed and put on record. It took some time to put together Goldfinger's extraordinary face, but the final result was an approximate likeness in monochrome. Bond dictated one or two notes about the sunburn, the colour of the hair, and the expression of the eyes, and the job was done.
"Would like to beat that on a dark night," commented the man from records. "I'll put it through to CID when they come on duty. You should get the answer by lunchtime."
Bond went back to the 7th floor. On the other side of the world it was around midnight. Eastern stations were closing down. There was a flurry of signals that had to be dealt with, the night's log to be written up, and then it was 8 o'clock. Bond telephoned the canteen for his breakfast. He had just finished it when there came the harsh purr of the red telephone. M? Why the hell had he got in 30 minutes early?
Yes, sir?
Come up to my office, 007. I want to have a word before you go off duty.
Sir?
Bond put the telephone back. He slipped on his coat and ran a hand through his hair, told the switchboard where he would be, took the night log, and went up in the lift to the 8th and top floor. Neither the desirable Miss Moneypenny nor the chief of staff was on duty. Bond knocked on M's door and went in.
"Sit down, 007.
M was going through the pipe-lighting routine. He looked pink and well-scrubbed. The lined sailor's face above the stiff white collar and loosely tied spotted bow tie was damnably brisk and cheerful. Bond was conscious of the black stubble on his own chin and of the all-night look of his skin and clothes. He sharpened his mind.
"Quiet night?"
M had got his pipe going. His hard, healthy eyes regarded Bond attentively. "Pretty quiet, sir. Station H." M raised his left hand an inch or two.
"Never mind. I'll read all about it in the log. Here, I'll take it."
Bond handed over the top-secret folder. M put it to one side. He smiled one of his rare, rather sardonic, bitten-off smiles.
"Things change, 007. I'm taking you off night duty for the present."
Bond's answering smile was taut. He felt the quickening of the pulse he had so often experienced in this room. M had got something for him. He said,
"I was just getting into it, sir."
"Quiet. "'Have plenty of opportunity later on. "'Something's come up. Odd business. "'Not really your line of country, except for one particular angle, which,'
M jerked his pipe sideways in a throwaway gesture,
"'may not be an angle at all.'
"'Bond sat back. He said nothing, waiting.
"'Had dinner with the governor of the bank last night. "'One's always hearing something new. "'At least all this was new to me. "'Gold, the seamy side of the stuff. "'Smuggling, counterfeiting, all that. "'Hadn't occurred to me that the Bank of England knew so much about crooks. "'Suppose it's part of the bank's job to protect our currency.'
"'M jerked his eyebrows up.
"'Know anything about gold?'
"'No, sir.
"'Well, you will by this afternoon. "'You've got an appointment with a man called Colonel Smithers at the bank at 4 o'clock. "'That give you enough time to get some sleep?'
"'Yes, sir.
"'Good. "'Seems that this man Smithers is head of the bank's research department. "'From what the governor told me, that's nothing more or less than a spy system. "'First time I knew they had one. "'Just shows what watertight compartments we all work in. "'Anyway,' "'Smithers and his chaps keep an eye out for anything fishy in the banking world, "'particularly any monkeying about with our currency and bullion reserves and what not. "'There was that business the other day of the Italians who were counterfeiting sovereigns, "'making them out of real gold, right carrots and all that. "'But apparently a sovereign or a French Napoleon is worth much more "'than its melted-down value in gold. "'Don't ask me why. "'Smithers can tell you that, if you're interested.' "'Anyway, the bank went after these people with a whole battery of lawyers. "'It wasn't technically a criminal offence. "'And after losing in the Italian courts, they finally nailed them in Switzerland. "'You probably read about it. "'Then there was that business of dollar balances in Beirut. "'Made quite a stir in the papers. "'Couldn't understand it myself. "'Some crack in the fence we put round our currency. "'The wide city boys had found it. "'Well, it's Smithers' job to smell out that kind of racket.' The reason the governor told me all this is because for years, almost since the war, apparently, Smithers has had a bee in his bonnet about some big gold leak out of England. Mostly deduction, plus some kind of instinct. Smithers admits he's got damned little to go on, but he's impressed the governor enough for him to get permission from the PM to call us in.
M broke off. He looked quizzically at Bond.
Ever wondered who are the richest men in England?
"'No, sir.
"'Well, have a guess. "'Or rather put it like this. "'Who are the richest Englishmen?'
"'Bond searched his mind. "'There were a lot of men who sounded rich, "'or who were made to sound rich by the newspapers, "'but who really had it, liquid, in the bank? "'He had to say something. "'He said hesitatingly, "'Well, sir, there's Sassoon, "'then that shipping man who keeps to himself, Ellerman. "'They say Lord Cowdrey is very rich.' There are the bankers, Rothschilds, Barings, Hambros. There was Williamson, the diamond man, Oppenheimer in South Africa. Some of the dukes may still have a lot of money. Bond's voice trailed away.
Not bad, not bad at all. But you've missed out the joker in the pack. Man I'd never thought of until the governor brought up his name. He's the richest of the lot. Man called Goldfinger. Auric Goldfinger.
Bond couldn't help himself. He laughed sharply.
"'What's the matter?'
M's voice was testy.
"'What the hell is there to laugh about?'
"'I'm sorry, sir.' Bond got hold of himself. "'The truth is, only last night I was building his face up on the Identicast.' He glanced at his watch. In a strangled voice he said, "'Be on its way to CID Records. Asked for a trace on him.' M was getting angry.
"'What the hell's all this about? Stop behaving like a bloody schoolboy!'
Bond said soberly, "'Well, sir, it's like this.' Bond told the story, leaving nothing out. M's face cleared. He listened with all his attention, leaning forward across the desk. When Bond had finished, M sat back in his chair. He said,
"'Well, well, well,'
on a diminishing scale. He put his hands behind his head and gazed for minutes at the ceiling. Bond could feel the laughter coming on again. How would the CID word the resounding snub he would get in the course of the day? He was brought sharply back to earth by M's next words.
"'By the way, what happened to that $10,000?'
"'Gave it to the girl, sir.'
"'Really? Why not to the White Cross?'
The White Cross Fund was for the families of Secret Service men and women who were killed on duty. "'Sorry, sir.' Bond was not prepared to argue that one.
Humph!
M had never approved of Bond's womanizing. It was anathema to his Victorian soul. He decided to let it pass. He said,
"Well, that's all for now, 007. You'll be hearing all about it this afternoon. Funny about Goldfinger. Odd chap. Seen him once or twice at Blades. He plays bridge there when he's in England. He's the chap the Bank of England's after."
M paused. He looked mildly across the table at Bond.
"As from this moment, so are you."
Chapter 6 Talk of Gold.
Bond walked up the steps and through the fine bronze portals and into the spacious, softly echoing entrance hall of the Bank of England, and looked around him. Under his feet glittered the brilliant golden patterns of the Boris Anrep mosaics. Beyond, through 25 feet high arched windows, green grass and geraniums blazed in the central courtyard. To right and left were spacious vistas of polished Hopton wood stone. Over all hung the neutral smell of air-conditioned air and the heavy, grave atmosphere of immense riches. One of the athletic-looking, pink frock-coated commissionaires came up to him.
"Yes, sir."
"Colonel Smithers?"
"Commander Bond, sir."
"This way, please." The commissioner moved off to the right, between the pillars. The bronze doors of a discreetly hidden lift stood open. The lift rose a few feet to the first floor. Now there was a long, panelled corridor ending in a tall Adam window. The floor was close-carpeted in beige Wilton. The commissioner knocked at the last of several finely carved oak doors that were just so much taller and more elegant than ordinary doors. A grey-haired woman was sitting at a desk. She looked as if she had once taken a double first. The walls of the room were lined with grey metal filing cabinets. The woman had been writing on a quarto pad of yellow memorandum paper. She smiled with a hint of conspiracy, picked up a telephone, and dialed a number.
"Commander Bond is here."
She put the telephone back and stood up.
"Will you come this way?"
She crossed the room to a door covered with green baize and held it open for Bond to go through. Colonel Smithers had risen from his desk. He said gravely,
"Nice of you to have come. Won't you sit down?"
Bond took the chair.
"Smoke?"
Colonel Smithers pushed forward a silver box of senior service and himself sat down and began to fill a pipe. Bond took a cigarette and lit it. Colonel Smithers looked exactly like someone who would be called Colonel Smithers. He had obviously been a colonel, probably on the staff, and he had the smooth, polished, basically serious mien that fitted his name. But for his horn-rimmed glasses, he might have been an efficient, not very well-fed courtier in a royal household. Bond felt boredom gathering in the corners of the room. He said encouragingly,
"It seems that you are to tell me all about gold."
"So I understand. I had a note from the governor. I gather I need keep nothing from you. Of course, you understand..."
Colonel Smithers looked over Bond's right shoulder.
"That most of what I shall have to say will be confidential."
The eyes swept quickly across Bond's face. Bond's face was stony. Colonel Smithers felt the silence that Bond had intended he should feel. He looked up, saw that he had put his foot in it, and tried to make amends.
"Obviously, I needn't have mentioned the point. A man with your training..."
Bond said, "We all think our own secrets are the only ones that matter. You're probably right to remind me. Other people's secrets are never quite as important as one's own. But you needn't worry. I shall discuss things with my chief, but with no one else."
"Quite. Quite. Nice of you to take it that way. In the bank one gets into the habit of being over-discreet. Now then..."
Colonel Smithers scurried for cover into his subject.
"This business of gold... I take it it's not a matter you've thought about a great deal?"
"I know it when I see it."
"Aha, yes. Well, now, the great thing to remember about gold is that it's the most valuable and most easily marketable commodity in the world. You can go to any town in the world, almost to any village, and hand over a piece of gold and get goods or services in exchange. Right?"
Colonel Smithers's voice had taken on a new briskness. His eyes were alight. He had his lecture pat. Bond sat back. He was prepared to listen to anyone who was master of his subject, any subject.
"And the next thing to remember,"
Colonel Smithers held up his pipe in warning,
is that gold is virtually untraceable. Sovereigns have no serial numbers. If gold bars have mint marks stamped on them, the marks can be shaved off, or the bar can be melted down and made into a new bar. That makes it almost impossible to check on the whereabouts of gold, or its origins, or its movements round the world. In England, for instance, we at the bank can only count the gold in our own vaults, in the vaults of other banks, and at the mint, and make a rough guess at the amounts held by the jewellery trade and the pawnbroking fraternity.
Why are you so anxious to know how much gold there is in England?
Because gold and currencies backed by gold are the foundation of our international credit. We can only tell what the true strength of the pound is, and other countries can only tell it, by knowing the amount of valuta we have behind our currency. And my main job, Mr. Bond,
Colonel Smithers's bland eyes had become unexpectedly sharp,
is to watch for any leakage of gold out of England, out of anywhere in the sterling area. And when I spot a leakage, an escape of gold towards some country where it can be exchanged more profitably than at our official buying price, it is my job to put the CID gold squad onto the fugitive gold and try to get it back into our vaults, plug the leak, and arrest the people responsible. And the trouble is, Mr. Bond,
Colonel Smithers gave a forlorn shrug of the shoulders,
that gold attracts the biggest, the most ingenious criminals. They are very hard indeed, to catch.
Isn't all this only a temporary phase? Why should this shortage of gold go on? They seem to be digging it out of Africa fast enough. Isn't there enough to go round? Isn't it just like any other black market that disappears when the supplies are stepped up, like the penicillin traffic after the war?
I'm afraid not, Mr. Bond. It isn't quite as easy as that. The population of the world is increasing at the rate of 5,400 every hour of the day. A small percentage of those people become gold hoarders, people who are frightened of currencies, who like to bury some sovereigns in the garden or under the bed. Another percentage needs gold fillings for their teeth. Others need gold-rimmed spectacles, jewellery, engagement rings. All these new people will be taking tons of gold off the market every year. New industries need gold wire, gold plating, amalgams of gold. Gold has extraordinary properties which are being put to new uses every day. It is brilliant, malleable, ductile, almost unalterable, and more dense than any of the common metals except platinum. There's no end to its uses, but it has two defects. It isn't hard enough. It wears out quickly, leaves itself on the linings of our pockets and in the sweat of our skins. Every year the world's stock is invisibly reduced by friction. I said that gold has two defects.
Colonel Smithers looked sad.
The other, and by far the major defect, is that it is the talisman of fear. Fear, Mr. Bond, takes gold out of circulation and hoards it against the evil day. In a period of history when every tomorrow may be the evil day, it is fair enough to say that a fat proportion of the gold that is dug out of one corner of the earth is at once buried again in another corner.
Bond smiled at Colonel Smithers's eloquence. This man lived gold, thought gold, dreamed gold. Well, it was an interesting subject. He might just as well wallow in the stuff. In the days when Bond had been after the diamond smugglers, he had had first to educate himself in the fascination, the myth, of the stones. He said, "What else ought I to know before we get down to your immediate problem?"
"You're not bored? Well, you were suggesting that gold production was so vast nowadays that it ought to take care of all these various consumers. Unfortunately, that is not so. In fact, the gold content of the world is being worked out. You may think that large areas of the world have still to be explored for gold. You would be mistaken. Broadly speaking, there only remains the land under the sea, and the sea itself, which has a notable gold content. People have been scratching the surface of the world for gold for thousands of years. There were the great gold treasures of Egypt and Mycenae, Montezuma and the Incas. Croesus and Midas emptied the Middle Eastern territories of gold. Europe was worked for it, the valleys of the Rhine and the Po, Malaga, and the plains of Granada. Cyprus was emptied, and the Balkans. India got the fever,
Ants coming up from under the earth, carrying grains of gold, led the Indians to their alluvial fields. The Romans worked Wales and Devon and Cornwall. In the Middle Ages there were the finds in Mexico and Peru. These were followed by the opening up of the Gold Coast, then called Negro Land, and after that came the Americas. The famous gold rushes of the Yukon and El Dorado, and the rich strikes at Eureka, sounded off the first modern gold age. Meanwhile, in Australia, Bendigo and Ballarat had come into production, and the Russian deposits at Lena and in the Urals were making Russia the largest gold producer in the world in the middle of the 19th century. Then came the second modern gold age, the discoveries on the Witwatersrand. These were helped by the new method of cyaniding instead of separation of the gold from the rock by mercury. Today we are in the third gold age, with the opening up of the Orange Free State deposits.
Colonel Smithers threw up his hands.
Now gold is pouring out of the earth. Why, the whole production of the Klondike and the Homestake and El Dorado, which were once the wonder of the world, would only add up to 2 or 3 years of today's production from Africa. Just to show you, from 1500 to 1900, when approximate figures were kept, the whole world produced about 18,000 tons of gold. From 1900 to today, we have dug up 41,000 tons. At this rate, Mr. Bond...
Colonel Smithers leaned forward earnestly.
And please don't quote me, but I wouldn't be surprised if in 50 years' time we have not totally exhausted the gold content of the earth.
Bond, smothered by this cataract of gold history, found no difficulty in looking as grave as Colonel Smithers. He said, "You certainly make a fascinating story of it. Perhaps the position isn't as bad as you think. They're already mining oil under the sea. Perhaps they'll find a way of mining gold. Now, about this smuggling..." The telephone rang. Colonel Smithers impatiently snatched up the receiver.
"Smithers speaking."
He listened, irritation growing on his face.
"I'm sure I sent you a note about the summer fixtures, Miss Philby. The next match is on Saturday against the discount houses."
He listened again.
"Well, if Mrs. Flake won't play goals, I'm afraid she'll have to stand down. It's the only position on the field we've got for her. Everybody can't play centre forward." "Yes, please do. Say, I'll be greatly obliged if just this once. I'm sure she'll be very good. Right figure and all that. Thank you, Miss Philby."
Colonel Smithers took out a handkerchief and mopped his forehead.
"Sorry about that. Sports and welfare are becoming almost too much of a fetish at the bank. I've just had the women's hockey team thrown into my lap, as if I hadn't got enough to do with the annual Gymkhana coming on. However..."
Colonel Smithers waved these minor irritations aside.
"As you say, time to get on to the smuggling. Well, to begin with, and taking only England and the Stirling area, it's a very big business indeed. We employ 3,000 staff at the bank, Mr. Bond, and of those no less than 1,000 work in the Exchange Control Department. Of those, at least 500, including my little outfit, are engaged in controlling the illicit movements of valuta, the attempts to smuggle or to evade the Exchange Control Regulations."
"That's a lot." Bond measured it against the Secret Service, which had a total force of 2,000. "Can you give me an example of smuggling? In gold? I can't understand these dollar swindles."
"All right."
Colonel Smithers now talked in the soft, tired voice of an overworked man in the service of his government. It was the voice of the specialist in a particular line of law enforcement. It said that he knew most things connected with that line and that he could make a good guess at all the rest. Bond knew the voice well. The voice of the first-class civil servant. Despite his prosiness, Bond was beginning to take to Colonel Smithers.
"All right. Supposing you have a bar of gold in your pocket about the size of a couple of packets of Players, weight about 5 1/4 pounds. Never mind for the moment where you got it from, stole it or inherited it or something. That'll be 24 carat, what we call 1,000 fine. Now, the law says you have to sell that to the Bank of England at the controlled price of £12.10 per ounce. That would make it worth around £1,000. But you're greedy. You've got a friend going to India, or perhaps you're on good terms with an airline pilot or a steward on the Far East run. All you have to do is cut your bar into thin sheets or plates. You'd soon find someone to do this for you. And sew the plates, they'd be smaller than playing cards, into a cotton belt, and pay your friend a commission to wear it. You could easily afford £100 for the job. Your friend flies off to Bombay and goes to the first bullion dealer in the bazaar. He will be given £1,700 for your £5 bar, and you're a richer man than you might have been. Mark you, Colonel Smithers waved his pipe airily, that's only 70% profit. Just after the war you could have got 300%. If you'd done only half a dozen little operations like that every year, you'd be able to retire by now.
Why the high price in India? Bond didn't really want to know. He thought M might ask him.
It's a long story. Briefly, India is shorter of gold, particularly for her jewellery trade, than any other country.
What's the size of this traffic?
Huge. To give you an idea, the Indian Intelligence Bureau and their customs captured 43,000 ounces in 1955. I doubt if that's 1% of the traffic. Gold's been coming into India from all points of the compass. Latest dodge is to fly it in from Macau and drop it by parachute to a reception committee, a ton at a time, like we used to drop supplies to the resistance during the war.
I see. Is there anywhere else I can get a good premium for my gold bar?
You could get a small premium in most countries, Switzerland, for instance, but it wouldn't be worth your while. India's still the place.
All right, said Bond. I think I've got the picture. Now, what's your particular problem? He sat back and lit a cigarette. He was greatly looking forward to hearing about Mr. Orrick Goldfinger. Colonel Smithers's eyes took on their hard, foxy look. He said,
"There's a man who came over to England in 1937. He was a refugee from Riga, name of Orrick Goldfinger. He was only 20 when he arrived, but he must have been a bright lad because he smelled that the Russians would be swallowing his country pretty soon. He was a jeweller and goldsmith by trade, like his father and grandfather, who had refined gold for Fabergé. He had a little money, and probably one of those belts of gold I was telling you about. Stole it from his father, I dare say. Well, soon after he had been naturalised, he was a harmless sort of chap and in a useful trade, and he had no difficulty in getting his papers, he started buying up small pawnbrokers all over the country. He put in his own men, paid them well, and changed the name of the shops to Goldfinger. Then he turned the shops over to selling cheap jewellery and buying old gold. You know the sort of place. Best prices for old gold, nothing too large, nothing too small. And he had his own particular slogan, "Buy her engagement ring with Granny's locket." Goldfinger did very well. Always chose good sites, just on the dividing line between the well-to-do streets and the lower middle. Never touched stolen goods, and got a good name everywhere with the police. He lived in London and toured his shops once a month and collected all the old gold. He wasn't interested in the jewellery side. He let his managers run that as they liked.
Colonel Smithers looked quizzically at Bond.
You may think these lockets and gold crosses and things are pretty small beer. So they are. But they mount up if you've got 20 little shops, each one buying perhaps half a dozen bits and pieces every week. Well, the war came, and Goldfinger, like all other jewellers, had to declare his stock of gold. I looked up his figure in our old records. It was 50 ounces for the whole chain. Just enough of a working stock to keep his shops supplied with ring setting, and so forth, what they call jeweller's findings in the trade. Of course, he was allowed to keep it. He tucked himself away in a machine-tool firm in Wales during the war, well out of the firing line, but kept as many of his shops operating as he could. Must have done well out of the GIs, who generally travel with a gold eagle or a Mexican $50 piece as a last reserve. Then, when peace broke out, Goldfinger got moving. He bought himself a house, pretentious sort of place, at Reculver, at the mouth of the Thames. He also invested in a well-found Brixham trawler, and an old Silver Ghost Rolls-Royce, armoured car built for some South American president who was killed before he could take delivery. He set up a little factory called Thanet Alloy Research in the grounds of his house and staffed it with a German metallurgist, a prisoner of war who didn't want to go back to Germany, and half a dozen Korean stevedores he picked up in Liverpool. They didn't know a word of any civilized language, so they weren't any security risk. Then, for 10 years, all we know is that he made one trip a year to India in his trawler, and a few trips in his car every year to Switzerland. Set up a subsidiary of his alloy company near Geneva. He kept his shops going, gave up collecting the old gold himself, used one of his Koreans, whom he had taught to drive a car. All right, perhaps Mr. Goldfinger is not a very honest man, but he behaves himself and keeps in well with the police. And with much more blatant fiddling going on all over the country, nobody paid him any attention.
Colonel Smithers broke off. He looked apologetically at Bond.
I'm not boring you. I do want you to get the picture of the sort of man this is. Quiet, careful, law-abiding, and with the sort of drive and single-mindedness we all admire. We didn't even hear of him until he suffered a slight misfortune. In the summer of 1954, his trawler, homeward bound from India, went ashore on the Goodwins, and he sold the wreck for a song to the Dover Salvage Company. When this company started breaking the ship up and got as far as the hold, they found the timbers impregnated with a sort of brown powder which they couldn't put a name to. They sent a specimen to a local chemist. They were surprised when he said the stuff was gold. I won't bother you with the formula, but you see, gold can be made to dissolve in a mixture of hydrochloric and nitric acids and reducing agents. Sulfur dioxide or oxalic acid precipitate the metal as a brown powder. This powder can be reconstituted into gold ingots by melting at around 1,000 degrees centigrade. I have to watch the chlorine gas, but otherwise it's a simple process. The usual nosy Parker in the salvage firm gossiped to one of the Dover customs men, and in due course a report filtered up through the police and the CID to me, together with a copy of the cargo clearance papers for each of Goldfinger's trips to India. These gave all the cargoes as mineral dust base for crop fertilizers, all perfectly credible because these modern fertilizers do use traces of various minerals in their makeup. The whole picture was clear as crystal. Goldfinger had been refining down his old gold, precipitating it into this brown powder, and shipping it to India as fertilizer. But could we pin it on him? We could not. Had a quiet look at his bank balance and tax returns. £20,000 at Barclays and Ramsgate. Income tax and super tax paid promptly each year. Figures showed the natural progress of a well-run jewellery business. We dressed a couple of the gold squad up and sent them down to knock on the door of Mr. Goldfinger's factory at Reculver. Sorry, sir. Routine inspection for the small engineering section of the Ministry of Labour. We have to make sure the factory acts are being observed for safety and health. Come in, come in. Mr. Goldfinger positively welcomed them. Mark you, he may have been tipped off by his bank manager or someone, but that factory was entirely devoted to designing a cheap alloy for jewellers' findings, trying out unusual metals like aluminium and tin, instead of the usual copper and nickel and palladium that are used in gold alloys. There were traces of gold about, of course, and furnaces to heat up to 2,000 degrees and so forth, but after all, Goldfinger was a jeweller, and a smelter in a small way, and all this was perfectly above board. The gold squad retired discomfited. Our legal department decided the brown dust in the trawler's timbers was not enough to prosecute on without supporting evidence, and that was more or less that. Except, Colonel Smithers slowly wagged the stem of his pipe, that I kept the file open and started sniffing around the banks of the world.
Colonel Smithers paused. The rumble of the city came through the half-open window high up in the wall behind his chair. Bond glanced surreptitiously at his watch. 5 o'clock. Colonel Smithers got up from his chair. He placed both hands palm downwards on the desk and leant forward.
"It took me 5 years, Mr. Bond, to find out that Mr. Goldfinger, in ready money, is the richest man in England. In Zurich, in Nassau, in Panama, in New York, he has £20 million worth of gold bars on safe deposit. And those bars, Mr. Bond, are not mint bars. They don't carry any official marks of origin whatsoever. They are bars that Mr. Goldfinger has melted himself. I flew to Nassau and had a look at the £5 million worth or so he holds there in the vaults of the Royal Bank of Canada. Oddly enough, like all artists, he couldn't refrain from signing his handiwork. It needs a microscope to see it, but somewhere, on each Goldfinger bar, a minute letter Z has been scratched in the metal. And that gold, or most of it, belongs to England. The bank can do nothing about it, so we are asking you to bring Mr. Goldfinger to book, Mr. Bond, and get that gold back. You know about the currency crisis and the high bank rate.
Of course.
Well, England needs that gold badly. And the quicker, the better.
Chapter 7 Thoughts in a DB3 Bond followed Colonel Smithers to the lift. While they waited for it, Bond glanced out of the tall window at the end of the passage. He was looking down into the deep well of the back courtyard of the bank. A trim, chocolate-brown lorry with no owner's name had come into the courtyard through the triple steel gates. Square cardboard boxes were being unloaded from it and put onto a short conveyor belt that disappeared into the bowels of the bank. Colonel Smithers came over.
"Fivers," he commented, "just up from our printing works at Loughton."
The lift came and they got in. Bond said, "I'm not very impressed by the new ones. They look like any other country's money. The old ones were the most beautiful money in the world." They walked across the entrance hall, now dimly lit and deserted. Colonel Smithers said,
"As a matter of fact, I agree with you. Trouble was that those Reichsbank forgeries during the war were a darn sight too good. When the Russians captured Berlin, amongst the loot they got hold of the plates. We asked the Narodny Bank for them, but they refused to give them up. We and the Treasury decided it was just too dangerous. At any moment, if Moscow had been inclined, they could have started a major raid on our currency. We had to withdraw the old fivers. The new ones aren't much to look at, but at least they'd be hell to forge."
The night guard let them out onto the steps. Threadneedle Street was almost deserted. The long city night was beginning. Bond said goodbye to Colonel Smithers and walked along to the tube. He had never thought very much about the Bank of England, but now that he had been inside the place, he decided that the old lady of Threadneedle Street might be old, but she still had some teeth left in her head. Bond had been told to report back to M at 6. He did so. M's face was no longer pink and shining. The long day had knocked it about, stressed it, shrunken it. When Bond went in and took the chair across the desk, he noticed the conscious effort M made to clear his mind, cope with a new problem the day was to fling at him. M straightened himself in his chair and reached for his pipe.
"Well?"
Bond knew the false belligerence of that particular bark. He told the gist of the story in less than 5 minutes. When he had finished, M said thoughtfully,
"Suppose we've got to take it on. Don't understand a thing about the pound and bank rate and all that, but everyone seems to be taking it damned seriously. Personally, I should have thought the strength of the pound depended on how hard we all worked, rather than how much gold we'd got. Germans didn't have much gold after the war. Look where they've got in 10 years. However, that's probably too easy an answer for the politicians, or more likely too difficult. Got any ideas how to tackle this chap Goldfinger? Any way of getting closer to him? Offering to do some dirty work for him, or something like that?"
Bond said thoughtfully, "I wouldn't get anywhere sucking up to him, asking him for a job or something of that sort, sir. I should say he's the sort of man who only respects people who are tougher or smarter than he is. I've given him one beating, and the only message I got from him was that he'd like me to play golf with him. Perhaps I'd better do just that."
"Fine way for one of my top men to spend his time."
The sarcasm in M's voice was weary, resigned.
"All right. Go ahead. But if what you say is right, you'd better see that you beat him. What's your cover story?"
Bond shrugged. "I hadn't thought, sir. Perhaps I'd better be thinking of leaving Universal Export. No future in it. Having a holiday while I look round. Thinking of emigrating to Canada. Fed up here, something like that. But perhaps I'd better play it the way the cards fall. I wouldn't think he's an easy man to fool."
"All right. Report progress. And don't think I'm not interested in this case."
M's voice had changed. So had his expression. His eyes had become urgent, commanding.
"Now, I'll give you one piece of information the bank didn't give you. It just happens that I also know what Mr. Goldfinger's gold bars look like. As a matter of fact, I was handling one today, scratched Z and all. It had come in with that haul we made last week when the Redland Resident Director's office caught fire in Tangier. You'll have seen the signals. Well, that's the 20th of these particular gold bars that have come our way since the war."
Bond interrupted. "But that Tangier bar was out of the Smash safe."
"Exactly. I've checked. All the other 19 bars with a scratched Z have been taken from Smash operatives."
M paused. He said mildly,
"Do you know, 007, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Goldfinger doesn't turn out to be the foreign banker, the treasurer, so to speak, of Smirsch.
James Bond flung the DB3 through the last mile of straight and did a racing change down into third, and then into second for the short hill before the inevitable traffic crawl through Rochester. Leashed in by the velvet claw of the front discs, the engine muttered its protest with a mild back popple from the twin exhausts. Bond went up into third again, beat the lights at the bottom of the hill, and slid resignedly up to the back of the queue that would crawl on for a quarter of an hour, if he was lucky, through the sprawl of Rochester and Chatham. Bond settled back into second and let the car idle. He reached for the wide gunmetal case of Morland cigarettes on the neighbouring bucket seat, fumbled for one and lit it from the dashboard. He had chosen the A2 in preference to the A20 to Sandwich, because he wanted to take a quick look at Goldfinger Land, Reculver and those melancholy forsaken reaches of the Thames which Goldfinger had chosen for his parish. He would then cross the Isle of Thanet to Ramsgate and leave his bag at the Channel Packet, have an early lunch, and be off to Sandwich. The car was from the pool. Bond had been offered the Aston Martin or a Jaguar 3.4. He had taken the DB3. Either of the cars would have suited his cover, a well-to-do, rather adventurous young man with a taste for the good, the fast things of life. But the DB3 had the advantage of an up-to-date triptyque, an inconspicuous colour, battleship grey, and certain extras which might or might not come in handy. These included switches to alter the type and colour of Bond's front and rear lights if he was following, or being followed at night, reinforced steel bumpers fore and aft in case he needed to ram, a long-barrelled Colt 45 in a trick compartment under the driver's seat, a radio pickup tuned to receive an apparatus called the Homer, and plenty of concealed space that would fox most customs men. Bond saw a chance and picked up 50 yards, sliding into a 10-yard gap left by a family saloon of slow reactions. The man at the wheel, who wore that infallible badge of the bad driver, a hat clamped firmly on the exact centre of his head, hooted angrily. Bond reached out of the window and raised an enigmatically clenched fist. The hooting stopped. And now, what about this theory of M's? It made sense. The Russians were notoriously incompetent payers of their men. Their centres were always running out of funds, their men complaining to Moscow that they couldn't afford a square meal. Perhaps Smersh couldn't get the valuta out of the Ministry of Home Security, or perhaps the Ministry of Home Security couldn't get the money out of the Ministry of Finance. But it had always been the same. Endless money troubles that resulted in missed chances, broken promises, and waste of dangerous radio time. It would make sense to have a clever financial brain somewhere outside Russia who could not only transmit funds to the centres, but also, in this case, make profits large enough to run the Smersh centres abroad without any financial assistance from Moscow. Not only that, on the side, Goldfinger was appreciably damaging the currency base of an enemy country. If all this was correct, it was typical of Smersh. A brilliant scheme faultlessly operated by an outstanding man. And that, reflected Bond as he roared up the hill into Chatham, putting half a dozen cars behind him, would partly explain Goldfinger's greed for more and still more money. Devotion to the cause, to Smersh, and perhaps the dangled prize of an Order of Lenin would be the spur to pick up even $10,000 or $20,000 when the odds were right and could be favourably adjusted. The funds for Red Revolution, for the discipline by fear that was the particular speciality of Smersh, could never be big enough. Goldfinger was not making the money for himself. He was making it for the conquest of the world. The minor risk of being found out, as he had been by Bond, was nothing. Why? What could the Bank of England get him if every single one of his past operations could be exposed? 2 years? 3? The traffic was thinning through the outskirts of Gillingham. Bond started motoring again, but easily now, not hurrying, following his thoughts as the hands and feet went through their automatic responses. So, in 37, Smersh must have sent Goldfinger out with the belt of gold round his young waist. He had shown his special aptitudes, his acquisitive bent, during his training in the spy school in Leningrad. He would have been told there would be a war, that he must dig himself in and start quietly accumulating. Goldfinger must never dirty his hands, never meet an agent, never receive or pass a message. Some routine would have been arranged. Second hand, 39 Vauxhall. First offer of £1,000 secures. Immaculate Rover, £2,000. Bentley, £5,000. Always an advertisement that would not attract attention or correspondence. The prices would be just too high, the description inadequate. In the agony column of the Times, perhaps. And, obediently, Goldfinger would leave the £2,000, or the £5,000 gold bar, at one of a very long series of post-boxes that had been arranged in Moscow before he left. A particular bridge, a hollow tree, under a rock, in a stream somewhere, anywhere in England. And he would never, on any account, visit that post-box again. It was up to Moscow to see that the agent got to the hidden treasure. Later, after the war, when Goldfinger was blossoming out, when he had become a big man, the post-boxes would no longer be bridges and trees. Now he would be given dates and safety deposit box numbers, left luggage lockers at stations. But still there would be the rule that Goldfinger must never revisit the scene, never endanger himself. Perhaps he would only get his instructions once a year, at a casual meeting in some park, in a letter slipped into his pocket on a train journey. But always it would be bars of gold, anonymous, untraceable if captured, except for the tiny Z that his vanity had scratched on his handiwork, and that a dull dog at the Bank of England called Colonel Smithers had happened upon in the course of his duties. Now Bond was running through the endless orchards of the Faversham growers. The sun had come out from behind the smog of London. There was the distant gleam of the Thames on his left. There was traffic on the river, long glistening tankers, stubby merchantmen, antediluvian Dutch schuits. Bond left the Canterbury Road and switched on to the incongruously rich highway that runs through the cheap bungaloid world of the holiday lands, Whitstable, Herne Bay, Birchington, Margate. He still idled along at 50, holding the racing wheel on a light rein, listening to the relaxed purr of the exhausts, fitting the bits of his thoughts into the jigsaw, as he had done two nights before with Goldfinger's face on the Identicast. And, Bond reflected, while Goldfinger was pumping £1 million, £2 million a year into the bloody maw of Smirsch, he was pyramiding his reserves, working on them, making them work for him whenever the odds were right, piling up the surplus for the day when the trumpets would sound in the Kremlin and every golden sinew would be mobilized. And no one outside Moscow had been watching the process. No one suspected that Goldfinger, the jeweller, the metallurgist, the resident of Reculver and Nassau, the respected member of Blades, of the Royal St. Mark's at Sandwich, was one of the greatest conspirators of all time. That he had financed the murder of hundreds, perhaps thousands of victims of Smersh all over the world. Smersh, Smertspionam, death to spies, the murder apparat of the High Presidium. And only M suspected it. Only Bond knew it. And here was Bond, launched against this man by a series of flukes, a train of coincidence that had been started by a plane breaking down on the other side of the world. Bond smiled grimly to himself. How often in his profession had it been the same? The tiny acorn of coincidence that soared into the mighty oak whose branches darkened the sky. And now, once again, he was setting out to bring the dreadful growth down. With what? A bag of golf clubs? A repainted sky-blue Ford Popular with large yellow ears was scurrying along the crown of the road ahead. Mechanically, Bond gave the horn ring a couple of short, polite jabs. There was no reaction. The Ford Popular was doing its 40. Why should anyone want to go more than that respectable speed? The Ford obstinately hunched its shoulders and kept on its course. Bond gave it a sharp blast, expecting it to swerve. He had to touch his brakes when it didn't. Damn the man! Of course. The usual tense figure, hands held too high up on the wheel, and the inevitable hat, this time a particularly hideous black bowler, square on a large bullet head. Oh well, thought Bond, they weren't his stomach ulcers. He changed down and contemptuously slammed the DB3 past on the inside. Silly bastard. Another 5 miles, and Bond was through the dainty telly-world of Herne Bay. The howl of Manston sounded away on his right. A flight of 3 Super Sabres came in to land. They skimmed below his right-hand horizon as if they were diving into the earth. With half his mind, Bond heard the roar of their jets catch up with them as they landed and taxied into the hangars. He came up with a crossroads. To the left, the signpost said Reculver. Underneath was the ancient monument sign for Reculver Church. Bond slowed but didn't stop. No hanging about. He motored slowly on, keeping his eyes open. The shoreline was too exposed for a trawler to do anything but beach or anchor. Probably Goldfinger had used Ramsgate. Quiet little port. Customs and police, who were probably only on the lookout for brandy coming over from France. There was a thick clump of trees between the road and the shore, a glimpse of roofs, and of a medium-sized factory chimney with a thin plume of light smoke or steam. That would be it. Soon there was the gate of a long drive. A discreet, authoritative sign said Thanet Alloys, and underneath, no admittance except on business. All very respectable. Bond drove slowly on. There was nothing more to be seen. He took the next right-hand turn across the Manston Plateau to Ramsgate. It was 12 o'clock. Bond inspected his room, a double with bathroom, on the top floor of the Channel Packet, unpacked his few belongings, and went down to the snack bar, where he had one vodka and tonic and two rounds of excellent ham sandwiches, with plenty of mustard. Then he got back into his car and drove slowly over to the Royal St. Mark's at Sandwich. Bond carried his clubs to the professional's shop and through to the workroom. Alfred Blacking was winding a new grip onto a driver. "Hello, Alfred." The professional looked up sharply. His sunburned, leathery face broke into a wide smile.
"Why, if it isn't Mr. James!"
They shook hands.
"Must be 15, 20 years. What brings you down here, sir? Someone was telling me only the other day that you were in the diplomatic or something. Always abroad."
"Well, I never."
"Still the same flat swing, sir?"
Alfred Blacking joined his hands and gave a low, flat sweep. "Afraid so, Alfred. Never had time to get myself out of it. How's Mrs. Blacking and Cecil?"
"Can't complain, sir. Cecil was runner-up in the Kent Championship last year. Should win it this year if he can only get out of the shop and onto the course a bit more."
This book is continued on Disc 3.